You know, in my case, I had, when I was young, I had a series of mentors who I kind of was a willing acolyte to, who shaped my aesthetic. And it's because of the towering strength of those people that I said, this is someone you have to kind of, you know, just go and sublimate your own desires and learn from. And that's kind of where my gut came from. I mean, in my case, it was when I was trying to work in theater, I had Stephen Sondheim, was a close friend and advisor for the period when I was trying to work in theater, and he, you know, really changed how I think about art. And then before I went to do Mishima, I spent 3 years working with Robert Wilson, the great international stage director, who, and Bob is a complete genius, and I adore him. And he, just being an apprentice to him and being one of his many producers working on his big international projects, was a hugely formative and nurturing experience. And then finally, Paul Schrader, because Schrader just sort of said, here, you're going to work in movies, come with me. And everything I learned about filmmaking, I learned at his side. So I feel like I'm always telling young people, I know you want to make your own films, and I know you think you know everything. And that's one way to do it, is to take an iPhone and just make a terrible first feature and then learn as you go. But I'm such a believer in mentorship. And when you have the time and when you're young, find people that you admire and put yourselves in their orbit and just absorb. And it will serve you so well later in life.
Obviously, it's important to know about our own cultures and something about world history. I think it's important to be aware of traditions, and including the religious traditions of our cultures, because they help to integrate and connect us. To abandon them means we're disintegrated and disconnected. Obviously, everyone needs to know about science and technology because they're such an important part of the modern world. But I would begin scientific courses by making it clear what's open questions and what are simply assumptions. I think it's important to be introduced to the culture, literature, music, and other forms of art and architecture, and the great buildings. Every ancient civilization has wonderful buildings as part of its culture, you know, like the great cathedrals of Europe or the temples of India. I think it's very important to connect with those as well. Nowadays, people's memories are probably getting worse because they look everything up on cell phones all the time. But I think learning certain things by heart is very important because it means they're then part of our being. Nothing can take them from us. So I think learning a few key prayers and poems appropriate to the culture one's growing up in are very important things to do as well. And that's not very much part of modern education. And of course, learning to sing and to dance and to celebrate and the elements of basic sports. And all these things are very important too. It's not just a matter of looking at screens most of the time. So I think these are some of the things which are important.
But I would like for young people to understand just how powerful they are, just how much what they do matters, that they really can make changes, that change themselves and change their communities, change readership, change what a readership can be, change people's idea about what a writer might look like, for instance, that we do have agency, that we do have power, that we can make differences. And I also would like for them to know that in order to do that, you have to make it a habit of trying. And nothing beats a failure but a try.
Animals have always been my teachers, my healers, my mentors, starting with my dog, Molly. She was a Scottish Terrier, and she was like the sister, the teacher, the angel I never had. And she was the one that showed me how to survive my childhood, actually. Emus in Australia, 3 wild emus, showed me the path that I needed to take to not work in an office and to work on my own. I had worked at a newspaper for 5 years, had an opportunity to go to Australia, joined Earthwatch, and had some field experience during a 2-week vacation in the Australian outback. And the principal investigator at the end of those 2 weeks says, I can see you're just on fire to do field research. I can't hire you and I can't give you any money, but if you ever wanted to research wild animals in Australia, you could stay at my camp and I'd give you food. So I quit my job and I moved to attend the outback. And I ended up following these three emus around, just seeing what they did all day. No one really had ever done that before. And they showed me, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
I think we have become quite disconnected. We should become more connected to rethink how to communicate and how to learn from the past, how to use this incredible heritage, cultural heritage that we have, and how to make it alive and how to translate it into our own times. I think there are tools that are now, of course, acknowledged, and which is the traditional way of teaching or learning, which is fundamental to our society. We should start to look around, to listen more, and to imagine something complementary to that, to expand. We don't want to reduce the tools, we want to expand the tools. So maybe to become a little bit more open and imaginative in creating bridges between different fields of knowledge, different methods of teaching and learning, different ways to transmit the knowledge.
To create the city of the future, and I see the city of the future as our common ground, we need to invest a lot on education. Education of the future practitioners, but also education of the future clients. And by client, I don't mean only governments or mecenates or investors. I mean each one of us. We should become responsible for our demand. To architects and to whoever is involved in the building process. And this is why I insist so much that education is the main tool to get there, because we have to educate ourselves, first of all, and prepare the future generations.
I was very lucky 21 years ago that Kofi Annan, who was then the Secretary General of the UN, asked me to be his advisor and to advise him specifically on what were called the Millennium Development Goals. These were the objectives that the UN nations adopted in September 2000 to fight poverty and to improve health and education. And the Sustainable Development Goals are the successor goals, the SDGs. I like the goals not only because of what they stand for, but because the whole world agreed on them. I like the idea that the world has agreed on something that we don't agree on very much. If I had to choose one, it is SDG number 4, that all kids should be in school, that everybody should get an education. If we're just badly educated, we're not going to make it on this planet. Let's empower young people so that they know the future. They know the world that they're going to be leading soon. They can do something about it. In fact, specifically Target 4.7, which says that everybody should learn about sustainable development. Everybody should learn about global citizenship. Everybody should learn tolerance for other people's cultures.
So thinking about how do you innovate such a archaic status quo system, such as the educational system, how are you going to be persuasive? What's the end game in terms of the skills and the knowledge base that we want for our children when they walk out of a high school or they walk out of a elementary school? What do we want them to look like? How do we want them to act? How do we want them to behave? It's hard to imagine too many people not thinking about, I want them to have social skills, some level of character and virtue, and I want them to be able to be somewhat independent and autonomous after being given instructions or guidance on an issue. And so from there, if you start with the question of what do we want them to look like, then you can go backwards and say, to what degree are we providing the blocks and the training to match up with those skills? And what you find very quickly is the answer is we're not even close, because we're focusing on important things, you know, math, reading, analytical skills, history. But when you get down to the metrics of how you want someone to walk through the world, you realize the fallibility of the current education system. And I really think that we really want to teach people critical thinking. I'm of the view that not all ideas are equal, but we really want to train people in terms of how can you work with information that is inferior? How can you figure out that information is inferior? And how do you kind of develop more superior information gathering strategies and decision-making processes?
You start seeing that, oh, we are becoming Earth as we're born into this physical dimension. We are becoming Earth. And then as we are living, during this time we are alive, we are becoming Earth. And when we are finished with this body, we are becoming Earth, because we say the ancestors have gone into the future. Now, this may be confusing. Ancestors are the future because they went ahead of us. They died. Their energy was here first in the past. Now they've gone on into the future. So we follow, and this is why we listen to elders, plants, the animals, all the energy that you see out here, the rocks. They were here long before any human being came. At least we know that. So who do we listen to? These are our ancestors. Not because I'm older or they're older in this lifetime. Because if we're alive as a baby born an hour ago to the one who just passes into another dimension, then we're all the same age. Energy doesn't have age. It's always here at this moment. Maybe that's another adaptation, how to do something in the Western context. Learn how to be here and listen to those indigenous peoples who've had this way long before it became a new agey thing. Be here now. Because when you're here, it contains both the present, future, and the past. You're able to know that your words don't come from your brain. They come from all that air, all the intelligences around us, the fire, everything. And when you're included in that, you feel so confident that you will always be cared for, because that's how Earth loves us. Earth loves you, loves everybody all the time, and we don't recognize that.
I'm one of six children. My parents had a large family, and I always kind of imagine us as, when I look back at childhood, as kind of feral cats running free, or maybe more like kind of seabirds. And you know, Mum would open the door and set us off for the day, and she wouldn't ring a bell and we'd come back. Her call would be enough to beckon us back for supper. My favorite singing voice is the voice of a curlew. Do you know the bird, the sound it makes? The bird with the long curved beak. And it does this kind of bubbling melancholy that develops into this hopeful kind of sound, and then it drips off. That's my favorite voice. And I suspect that, along with the sound of other seabirds, was pretty prominent in my youth. But also, I grew up surrounded by traditional folk music, the Scottish folk music, but of course, Scandinavian folk music, Shetland music, reels, strathspeys and reels. So that was quite, I think, probably my first introduction to the sound of a violin would have been the fiddle, you know, and hearing a reel, which is a quick dance. And of course, yes, the sound of the waves and the changing weather. It changes five times a day in Orkney.
Also, part of the joy of what we do as writers is discovery. Part of the joy of what we do is surprise. Part of the joy of what we do is that you sit down, you write a few words, and suddenly you see something, you see yourself say something you didn't expect to say. And so you sort of follow that thread, and then you say another thing you didn't expect to say. One of the things I say to them is that our job as writers is to write what will become cliche. Not to write cliches, but to be original enough that we make something that people are still saying, that we say the thing that characterizes thought on a subject for hundreds of years to come. And if that's what you're doing, that's pretty powerful. You're in a position of power.
I would like to see philosophy taught as being essentially about how we ought to live, about what it is to live a good life and why we should lead that kind of life. To me, that's the central questions. It was for Socrates in ancient Athens. He said an unexamined life is not worth living. So I think we should think of philosophy as encouraging students, young people, to examine their lives and to think about how they want to live. Now, this is part of the effective altruism movement. Living altruistically ought to be a part of our life, not the whole of our life. We don't expect people to be saints, but thinking about making the world a better place should be one of our objectives for everybody. And insofar as we do try to make the world a better place, we should use the resources that we can spare for that, whether that's putting time into it or putting our skills into it or donating money. We should use those resources as effectively as possible to get the most amount of good out of them for what we're doing for the world.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation, a This podcast is created by Maria Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Max Richter's music featured in this episode was On the Nature of Daylight from the Blue Note Books. Music is courtesy of Max Richter, Universal Music Enterprises, and Mute Song. We hope you've enjoyed this program. To hear more from these guests, listen to their full interviews. To learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.